Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eileen McKillop for Appellant Lana Choi. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue here in this case is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in vacating a default judgment as to damages only. It's important to note in this case that there has been no appeal of the June 27, 2013 default order. The court held an evidentiary hearing on November 15, 2013, and ruled that that default order stands. There's been no appeal of that default order. The only issue before the court here is what the court based its decision.
Well, it stands as to liability, but not as to damages.
Correct, Your Honor, as to damages. We're only dealing with a damages issue here. The court based its decision on vacating the damages solely on the fact that the court erred in believing that once a party has been adjudged to be in default, that if that party then appears after being adjudged in default, that that party is entitled to notice of a default or as a damages hearing for the default judgment. In this case, I believe CR 55A3 clearly provides that a defendant is not entitled to notice once they've been adjudged in default. And we were not required, Ms. Choi was not required to give the defendant any notice of a damages hearing.
What about the Marin case and substantial compliance with the appearance and notice requirements?
As far as the defendant?
Yes.
In the Marin?
And being entitled to notice.
Correct.
Under Marin,
yes.
The court very clearly sets forth the opportunity to establish substantial compliance and therefore an entitlement to notice.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the court did not base its decision on vacating the default judgment as to damages based on any factors in Morin v. Burris. In this case, they didn't. And one of those issues was whether or not the, in Morin.
What's your position about what the court based its determination on?
The court based its determination strictly on the fact that the court believed that once a party has appeared, even after being judged in default, they're still entitled to notice of a damages hearing. And that's pretty clear from the court's order. The court did not base it on any other factor in this case.
Well, are you taking the position the record does not support substantial compliance with?
That's also true, Your Honor. I even went through that. And as to damages here, I mean, that's what we're dealing with as to damages, the default judgment as to damages. In this case, they didn't provide any of the factors in White v. Holm. They didn't provide any evidence whatsoever of a prima facie defense as to damages. All they did, they didn't have any affidavits, any declarations attesting to this. The only thing that the defense offered was they felt that it was, you know, unsubstantiated and just an allegation. And that is not.
So let's get to this whole issue of filing.
Sure. Okay.
Now. Because it's very clear, well, maybe it's not so clear, but from looking at the record, I know that you filed with the King County Superior Court clerk the amended motion, the amended declaration, et cetera, after the appeal was pending. I know that you, as part of your declaration in opposition to the motion to show cause why the default order should not be vacated, you attached those documents.
Yes, I attached them.
Those documents do not indicate that they were ever filed with the King County clerk. You've attached some sort of document, I guess, showing that there was e-filing with the ex-party commissioner?
Yeah, here's, Your Honor, this was not raised at all.
Well, whether it's raised or not, it goes to the argument that I think the defense is making, and that is that the motion wasn't filed. And this is a technical argument related to the wording of the rule. But so that we can understand, you filed your motion, your amended motion, your amended declaration, and Ms. Choi's amended declaration with ex parte. Those documents were not filed with the King County clerk at the time, were they?
No. Here's Your Honor. What What they did was they filed a motion to vacate the default order.
I know what
That's
they did.
That's where I filed.
You did.
September 18, 2013, I filed my – that's where you're getting that.
I see those documents. Those
yes.
documents do not indicate a Superior Court clerk stamp. There's no indication on, in the record that we have that you ever filed those documents with the King County clerk until after the appeal was filed.
Here, Your Honor.
Is that true or not?
No. Well, not that I thought and not that
well,
I think.
Well, not whether you thought it or not, there's no document that we have in the record that shows that the motion or the declarations were filed with the King County Superior Court clerk until after the appeal is filed.
Well, that's actually not exactly true. Now, here's the thing, Your Honor. I know this has been brought up on appeal because it's not an issue that the trial court used at all. And I understand. I think the court cannot consider any issues that were not raised at the trial court on a motion to vacate a default judgment. This has to be the court has to look at what the court based its decision on and cannot base it on new grounds and issues that were raised. Because, Your Honor, that would have been something, if they had raised that, we could have addressed it down below, would have decided whether or not we appealed or not. Now we're somewhat prejudiced because I wasn't even aware of this issue.
Well, apparently you were because you filed these documents after the appeal was filed.
Well, the only reason I did is because I saw that it wasn't specifically on the court docket. I didn't know why. At all, and I still thought that the court had.
It was not on the court docket because those documents were never filed with the
court.
Well,
see, Your Honor, I didn't think that, and I, you know, I thought that since we provided the e-filing that they were. So I guess the important thing is in this case, Your Honor, that I think we have to look at what the trial court used as far as a basis for vacating. I know Your Honor wants to address this. On appeal, but I don't believe this court can address a new issue for vacating a default judgment. That wasn't brought up. They've waived that. Right. We have a default order that has not been vacated. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court, my name is Martin Zients. I am here on behalf of respondent Ashley Young. I wanted to bring to the court's attention something that has troubled me as we have addressed this issue of filing, and attached to the appellant's reply brief was the page that she said repeatedly in her reply brief demonstrated that she had in fact e-filed her motion for default judgment. I'm looking at Appendix A1. It says, official confirmation of ex parte documents and printing options. It lists each of the documents for the motion for default judgment and reads after whether it was filed, the answer is no, 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 and no.
So, okay, well, assuming that issue is waived because it wasn't raised below, we have the trial court's finding that you were entitled to notice and the argument that you have not met the factors under White versus Holmes. So why don't you address those two separate arguments? Was there any argument related to substantial compliance with the notice requirement?
To Judge Rietschel in the court below?
Yes,
the argument that was made, and I wasn't present in court, so I can only report based on reading the record, was that my partner, Mr. Pizer, who had recovered enough to go to court at that point, took the position that having given a notice of appearance to opposing counsel as soon as he became aware of the order of default, that he was under the impression that was compliance with notice requirements, that he would then be entitled to notice of subsequent pleadings. I don't think that he got to a more articulate and developed position of citing Morin versus Burris and saying thereby there's been substantial compliance.
Well, in the appellate brief, there's a lot of discussion about guts.
Yes.
And Guts is one of the three consolidated cases in Morin. I mean, that's how I got to Morin.
But what I'm saying, and I'm agreeing with you, that in the early phase, when we were talking about the motion to vacate the order of default, Morin wasn't raised because a default judgment was unknown to my partner until just before the hearing
right.
on the motion for the order for default. But when the motion to vacate the default judgment was made, a Morin was cited. So that issue of substantial compliance was
raised. Well, and the motion
raised.
To vacate the default judgment was the motion that was heard in front of Judge Ritchell.
Right.
And so in front of Judge Ritchell, then you're taking the position that Morin was being relied on?
Yes. Yes. That's my understanding and recollection of the record, that Morin was cited to her, although I'd want to check that those briefs just to verify that. But the point being, whether it was cited or not, Judge Ritchell was under the impression that substantial compliance had been rendered
now,
by the
notice.
Now,
how do you know that?
By virtue of her ruling when she made the finding of fact, that was, I believe, number two, that the motion for default judgment was made after the notice of appearance had been filed.
Well, but under the rule, technically, you're not entitled to notice if you haven't filed a notice of appearance before the order of default.
And I am essentially saying what I thought you were implying earlier in your questions, which is that if someone has appeared subsequent to Morin versus Burris, my reading of the law is if someone has appeared between the notice of appearance
and the
motion for default judgment, they are entitled to notice of the motion for default judgment.
So that's a substantial compliance argument.
That's the substantial compliance argument.
So here the notice of appearance was filed on July 17th, and the order of default was entered on July 30th.
The default judgment was entered July 30th. And our first notice of the default judgment was on September 18th when it was attached to the reply brief.
So now let's talk about White versus Holmes, the four-part test as to damages.
Yes,
the argument is, well, you didn't present any evidence, therefore you haven't made a prima facie showing of a defense as to damages.
Should I start with damages, Your Honor?
I think they're focusing on damages,
okay.
So you might as well.
Well.
I mean, I understand there were disputes about service, so.
Yes. There's an evidentiary answer, and then there is a precedent answer. The evidentiary answer is that what we did in challenging the damages was that we said to Judge Ritchell, let's go through piece by piece the evidence that supports the damages award. And what we showed her was that there was a claim, for example, that the plaintiff was suffering from an extended period of emotional distress from not being able to work. And we said in her own declaration, she says she went back to work and started making more money in 2011 and 2012. And separately, we said she's made a claim that she is suffering numbness down through her legs. We said, look at the medical records, Your Honor, that she has attached. It shows that the numbness problem dissipated and no longer existed after a short while, so that the evidence on which she is relying to support the claims that show up in her declaration are unsupported by those records. There's nothing that bars the defendant from pointing out that the records advanced before the court below don't support the assertion made by the declarant in her declaration. But then there is the procedural, or let's call it a precedent answer, and that is that if we're proceeding with regard to a sum uncertain under CR 55, and there are aspects of the claims made, including the wage loss and the pain and suffering, that do not seem to be easily locked in as a sum certain, but instead require development of testimony and discovery. There are many cases, and we did indeed cite them. In fact, one of the cases that was cited by plaintiff's counsel, the JUB case, involved a decision by the court that where the defendant presents evidence that there has not been adequate development of the damages that support the default judgment, it's appropriate for the court to deny the or to vacate the default judgment and to require an evidentiary hearing. So our position is that this is a case that is fairly simple. It's an abuse of discretion standard, which is a tough standard for the plaintiff to get over.
And there was also, I think the court made a finding that there was a prima facie defense as to service of process.
Absolutely.
And there was, I know, a lot of evidence put in at that stage.
That's right. We have two prima facie defenses. The burden under White versus Holm and under Morin and under Pfaff versus State Farm, those three cases say that all reasonable inferences, it's like the summary judgment, all reasonable inferences for purposes of vacating the default judgment go in favor of the moving party, the defendant.
So what about due diligence and excusable neglect?
Okay. As you recall, and it sounds like you know this area of law very well, we have the primary factors of prima facie defense. We've got two of them, and excusable neglect. We've got one of them, that the defendant didn't think she had been served based on her claim that it was her friend, Lindsay, that had been served. Now, the lesser factors are due diligence and substantial hardship to the defendant. We believe we've satisfied the substantial and major factors. On the secondary factors, due diligence, the record or the calendar is very clear, and I'm sure you have looked at it as I have looked at it, and what it boils down to it is a fairly simple proposition. There's a lawyer in my firm who thought that by having a notice of appearance in, he would get notice of subsequent pleadings. He didn't. Maybe he was mistaken about that. Maybe he's right about that. I think under Morin versus Burris, he was right about that. But the question is, did he act promptly? There are many cases where lawyers wait for months to do something. If it were months, and I'm talking about several months, then probably not. Probably the due diligence standard would not be met. But remember that he did, A, get the notice of appearance in when we filed the motion for default. That was my filing that back on September 12th. On September 18th, we found out there was a default judgment that was entered. Our motion to vacate the default judgment was on October 8th. So from the time we knew about the default judgment until the time I filed the motion to vacate the default judgment was 20 days. Under those timelines, Your Honor, I would submit we met the due diligence standard. And the circumstances of a defendant who didn't think she'd been served and a defense attorney who had two cancer surgeries and was fighting serious health issues, that is an opportunity for the court to exercise its discretion. It did. It did not abuse its discretion. It did so for reasonable grounds, on tenable grounds, for tenable reasons, and under those, under that rationale, we would assert we had met the standard of White versus Holm. Your Honor, unless
you... Your time is up.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to address one issue that has been raised here, is that some prima facie defense has to service a process. The court held an evidentiary hearing on 11/15.
Well, that was afterwards. I think, by simply appealing the one order, that's what we're focused on.
Okay.
And the question is, what did the court have before it at that time?
Okay.
And so what's your argument about why the court erred in making that finding at that time, not based on what happened at the evidentiary hearing?
Correct. Your Honor.
The prima facie defense of lack of service.
Yes, the court didn't address that at all, and found
there's a finding.
Yeah, there's a finding that they did not present a prima facie defense as to service of process. It was a clear. It had the standard was they had evidentiary hearing. The standard was they had to provide clear and convincing evidence. They didn't, and the court ruled after the evidentiary hearing that they hadn't.
Right, but what did the court? What's your position about why the court erred in entering the finding on October 22nd as to lack of service based on what the court had in front of it?
The reason the court ordered a vacating of the default judgment was due strictly to the notice issue. And also they did present...
Well, that's not what the order indicates.
The order indicates defendant has shown that the default judgment hearing was attained by plaintiff without notice and after defendant had entered a notice of appearance.
But that's not the only finding.
But the court also crossed out shown lack of personal jurisdiction and met the four-part test of White v. Holmes. Cross that out. So that is in the court's order as being crossed out. So the court based it solely.
Well, not, no, because the court makes a finding as to prima facie defense as to damages.
That's correct in her 11-15-13 order. And the court, the only thing that the court could base that on is what they filed afterwards. And the only evidence they had was a declaration of Ms. Young's attorney stating that I just feel that these damages are excessive. They didn't present any other evidence other than say she only had $1,833 worth of medical bills. It should have been more. We had an explanation for that. And that she didn't have any time loss after 2010. I mean, that was it. The court based its decision, the court commissioner, on a detailed declaration of Ms. Choi explaining all her medical, what her symptoms were, what her problems were, and what her treatment was. And the reason why she didn't have treatment after that, because she couldn't afford to have any medical treatment. So the court really, there was no prima facie, and there's no White v. Holmes. They didn't satisfy any of the requirements of White v. Holmes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.